Chapter 43. Maliki's barrister is successful. He provides passes for my mother and my brother Alfie on the SS Sylvania, which arrives in New York on December 21st, 1959. When they emerge from the customs shed, there's a piece of broken leather flapping from Mam's right shoe, so that you can see the small toe of a foot that was always swollen. Does it ever end? Is this the family of the broken shoe? We embrace, and Alfie smiles with broken, blackened teeth. The family of broken shoes and teeth destroyed. Will this be our coat of arms? Mam looks past me to the street beyond. Where's Maliki? I don't know. He should be here in a minute. She tells me I look fine, that it didn't do me any harm to put on a bit of weight, though I should do something about my eyes, they're that red. That irritates me because I know that if I even think of my eyes or anyone mentions them, I can feel them flush red, and of course she notices. See, she says, you're a bit old to be having bad eyes. I want to snap at her that I'm 29, and I don't know the proper age for not having bad eyes, and is this what she wants to talk about the minute she arrives in New York? But Maliki arrives in a taxi with his wife Linda. More smiles and embraces. Maliki keeps the taxi while we retrieve the suitcases. Alfie says, will we put these in the boot? Linda smiles. Oh no, we put them in the trunk. Trunk? We didn't bring a trunk. No, no, she says. We put your bags in the trunk of the taxi. Isn't there a boot in the taxi? No, that's the trunk. Alfie scratches his head and smiles again, a young man understanding lesson number one in American English. In the taxi, Mam says, Lord above, look at all those motor cars. The roads are packed. I tell her it's not so bad now. An hour earlier, it was the height of the rush hour, and traffic was even worse. She says she doesn't see how it could ever be worse. I tell her it's always worse earlier, and she says, I don't see how it could be worse than this, the way the motor cars are crawling along this minute. I am trying to be patient, and I speak slowly. I am telling you, ma'am, this is how the traffic is in New York. I live here. Maliki says, oh, it doesn't matter. It's a lovely morning. And she says, I lived here too, in case you've forgotten. You did, I tell her, 25 years ago, and you lived in Brooklyn, not Manhattan. Well, it's still New York. She won't give up, and I won't, though I'm looking at the pettiness of the two of us and wondering why I'm arguing instead of celebrating the arrival of my mother and my youngest brother in the city all of us dreamed of all our lives. Why does she pick on my eyes, and why do I have to contradict her over the traffic? Linda tries to ease the moment. Well, as Maliki says, it's a beautiful day. Mam gives a little begrudging nod. Tis. And how was the weather when you left Ireland, ma'am? A begrudging word. Raining. Oh, it's always raining in Ireland, isn't it, ma'am? No, it's not. And she folds her arms and stares straight ahead at the traffic that was much busier an hour earlier. At the apartment, Linda makes breakfast while Mam dandles the new baby, Siobhan, and croons to her the way she crooned to seven of us. Linda says, Mam, would you like tea or coffee? Tea, please. When the breakfast is ready, Mam puts the baby down, comes to the table, and wants to know what is that thing floating around in her cup. Linda tells her it's a tea bag, and Mam puts her nose in the air. Oh, I wouldn't drink that. Sure, that's not proper tea at all. Maliki's face tightens, and he tells her through his teeth, that's the tea we have. That's the way we make it. We don't have a pound of lion's tea and a teapot for you. Well then, I won't have anything. I'll just eat my egg. I don't know what kind of a country this is where you can't get a decent cup of tea. Maliki is ready to say something, but the baby cries and he goes to lift her from her crib while Linda flutters around Mam, smiling, trying to please. We could get a teapot, Mam, and we could get loose tea, couldn't we, Maliki? But he's parading the living room with the baby whimpering on his shoulder. And you can see that in the matter of tea bags, he won't yield, not this morning anyway. Like anyone who has ever had a decent cup of tea in Ireland, he despises tea bags. But he has an American wife who knows nothing but tea bags. He has a baby and things on his mind, and little patience with this mother with her nose in the air over tea bags, her first day in the United States of America. And he doesn't know why, after all his expense and trouble, he has to tolerate her picky ways for the next 3 weeks in this small apartment. Ma'am pushes away from the table. Lavatory? She asks Linda. Where's the lavatory? What? Lavatory. WC. Linda looks at Maliki. The toilet, he says. The bathroom. Oh, says Linda. In there. While Ma'am is in the bathroom, Alfie tells Linda the tea bag wasn't that bad after all. If you didn't see it floating in the cup, you'd think it was all right. And Linda smiles again. She tells him that's why the Chinese don't serve great chunks of meat. They don't like looking at the animal they're eating. If they cook chicken, they chop it into little pieces and mix it with the other things so you barely know it's chicken. That's why you never see a chicken leg or breast in a Chinese restaurant. Is that right? Alfie says. The baby is still whimpering on Maliki's shoulder, but all is sweet at the table, with Alfie and Linda discussing tea bags and the delicacy of Chinese cooking. Then Ma'am comes from the bathroom and tells Maliki, that child is full of wind, so she is. I'll take her. Maliki hands over Siobhan and sits at the table with his tea. Ma'am walks the floor with a piece of leather flapping from her broken shoe. And I know I'll have to take her down Third Avenue to a shoe shop. She pats the baby, and there's a powerful burp that makes us all laugh. She puts the baby back in the crib and leans over her. There, there, Lanov, there, there, and the baby gurgles. She returns to the table, rests her hands in her lap, and tells us, I'd give me two eyes for a decent cup of tea. And Linda tells her she'll go out today and get a teapot and loose tea. Right, Maliki? He says, right. Because he knows in his heart there's nothing like tea made in a pot which you rinse with water boiling madly, where there's a heaping spoon for each cup, where you pour in the madly boiling water, keeping the pot warm with the tea cozy while the tea brews for 6 minutes exactly. Maliki knows that's how Ma'am will make tea, and he softens his stand on tea bags. He knows also that in the matter of baby burping, she has finer instincts and superior ways. And it's a fair exchange. A decent cup of tea for her and comfort for the baby Siobhan. For the first time in 10 years we're all together, Ma'am and her four sons. Maliki has his wife Linda and his baby Siobhan, the first of a new generation. Michael has a girlfriend Jan, and Alfie will soon find one too. I'm reconciled with Alberta and living with her in Brooklyn. Maliki is the life of the party in New York, and no party can start without him. If he doesn't appear, there's restlessness and whimpering. Where's Maliki? Where's your brother? And when he roars in, they're happy. He sings and drinks and passes his glass for more drink, and sings again till he rushes off to the next party. Ma'am loves the life, the excitement of it. She loves having a highball at Maliki's bar, and being introduced as Maliki's mother. Her eyes twinkle, and her cheeks glow, and she dazzles the world with a flash of false teeth. She follows Maliki to the parties, the all-hoolies, she calls them, basks in the mother's spotlight, and tries to join in Maliki's songs, till she runs out of breath with the first signs of emphysema. After all the years sitting by the fire in Limerick, wondering where the next loaf of bread was coming from, she's having a lovely time, and isn't this a grand country altogether? Ah, maybe she'll stay a little longer. Sure, what's the use of going back to Limerick in the middle of the winter with nothing to do but sit there by the fire warming her poor shins? She'll go back when the weather warms up, Easter maybe, and Alfie can get a job here to keep them going. Maliki has to tell her, if she wants to stay in New York even for a short time, She can't stay with him in his small apartment with Linda and the baby, 4 months old. She calls me at Alberta's and tells me, I'm hurted, so I am. 4 sons in New York and no place for me to lay my head. But we all have small apartments, ma'am. No room. Well, one would wonder what you're all doing with the money you're making. You could have told me this before you dragged me from my own comfortable fireplace. No one dragged you. Didn't you say over and over you wanted to come for Christmas, and didn't Maliki pay your fare? I came because I wanted to see my first grandchild, and don't worry, I'll pay Maliki back if I have to get down on my own 2 knees and scrub floors. If I knew the way I was going to be treated here, I would have stayed in Limerick and had a nice goose for myself and a roof over my head. Alberta whispers I should invite Ma'am and Alfie for dinner on Saturday night. There's silence at the other end, and then a sniffle. Well, I don't know what I'll be doing on Saturday night. Maliki said there might be a party. All right. We invited you to dinner, but if you want to go to another party with Maliki, go. You don't have to sound so huffy. It's an awful long distance to Brooklyn. I know because I used to live there. It's less than half an hour. She whispers something to Alfie and he takes the phone. Francis, we'll come. When I open the door, she brings her own chill along with the January chill. She acknowledges Alberta's existence with a nod and asks if I have a match for her cigarette. Alberta offers her a cigarette, but she says no, she has her own, and these American cigarettes barely have any taste anyway. Alberta offers her a drink and she'll have a highball. Alfie says he'll have a beer, and Ma'am says, oh, you're starting, are you? I tell her it's only a beer. But that's how it starts, one beer, and the next thing you're roaring and singing and waking the child. There's no child here. There is in Maliki's house, and the roaring and singing too. Alberta calls us into dinner. Tuna casserole with green salad. Ma'am takes her time coming to the table. She has to finish her cigarette, and what's the hurry anyway? Alberta says it's nice to eat casserole when it's good and hot. Ma'am says she hates hot food that burns the roof of your mouth. I tell her, for Christ's sake, finish your cigarette and come to the table. She comes with her offended look. She pulls her chair in and pushes the salad away. She doesn't like the lettuce in this country. I try to control myself. I ask her, what the hell is the difference between the lettuce in this country and the lettuce in Ireland? She says there's a big difference, that the lettuce in this country is tasteless. Alberta says, oh, never mind, not everyone likes lettuce anyway. Ma'am stares at her casserole and forks noodles and tuna aside while she hunts for peas. She says she loves peas, though these are not as good as the ones in Limerick. Alberta asks if she'd like more peas. No, thank you. After which she probes the noodles for bits of tuna. I ask her, don't you like the noodles? What? The noodles. Don't you like them? I don't know what they are, but I'm not fond of them. I want to lean into her face and tell her she's acting like a savage, that Alberta went to great lengths thinking of something that might please her, and all she can do now is sit with her nose in the air as if someone had done something to her, and if she doesn't like it, she can put on her damn coat and go back to Manhattan to the party she's missing, and I'll never bother her again with an invitation to dinner. I want to say all this, but Alberta makes peace. Oh, that's all right. Maybe Ma'am is tired with the excitement of coming to New York, and if we have a nice cup of tea and a piece of cake, we'll all relax. Ma'am says, no thank you to the cake. She couldn't eat another morsel, but she would like a cup of tea till, again, she sees the tea bag in her cup and tells us this isn't the proper cup of tea at all. I tell her, that's what we have, and that's what she's getting. Though what I don't tell her is that I'd like to throw the tea bag between her eyes. She said no to the cake, but here she is pushing it into her mouth and swallowing with hardly a chew, and then picking up and eating the crumbs from around her plate, the woman who didn't want the cake. She glances at the teacup. Well, if that's the only tea you have, I suppose I'll have to drink it. She lifts the tea bag on her spoon and squeezes it till the water turns brown and wants to know why there's a lemon on her saucer. Alberta says some people like lemon with their tea. Mam says she'll never heard the likes of that. It's disgusting. Alberta removes the lemon, and Mam says she'd like milk and sugar if you don't mind. She asks for a match for her cigarette and smokes while she drinks only half the tea to show she doesn't care for it. Alberta asks if she and Alfie would like to see a movie in the neighborhood, but Mam says no, they have to be getting back to Manhattan, and it's too late. Alberta says it isn't that late, and Mam says it's late enough. I walk with my mother and Alfie up Henry Street and over to the subway at Borough Hall. It's a bright January night, and all along the street there are still Christmas lights glowing and flickering in the windows. Alfie talks about the elegance of the houses and says, thanks for the dinner. Mam says she doesn't know why people can't put dinner in a bowl and give it to you without a plate under it. She thinks that kind of thing is putting on airs. When the train comes in, I shake hands with Alfie. I bend over to kiss my mother and hand her a $20 bill. But she pulls her face away and sits in the train with her back to me, and I walk away with the money back in my pocket. Chapter 44. For 8 years, I traveled on the Staten Island Ferry. I would take the double R train from Brooklyn to Whitehall Street in Manhattan, walk to the terminal, slip a nickel into the turnstile slot, buy coffee and a donut, plain, no sugar, and wait on a bench with a newspaper filled with yesterday's disasters. Mr. Jones taught music at McKee High School, though when you saw him on the ferry, you might have thought he was a university professor or head of a law firm. You might have thought that, even though he was a Negro who would become a black, and in later years, an African-American. Every day he wore a different three-piece suit and a hat to match. He wore shirts with collars or held in place with gold stick pins. His watch and rings were gold, too, and delicate. The old Italian shoeshine men loved him for the daily trade and generous tips, and they left his shoes dazzling. Every morning he read the Times and held it with fingers protruding from little leather gloves that cover the area below the wrist to beyond the knuckles. He smiled when he told me of concerts and operas he'd attended the night before, or of summer trips to Europe, especially to Milan and Salzburg. He put his hand in my arm and told me I must not die before I sit in La Scala. Another teacher joked one morning that the kids at McKee must be impressed with his clothes, all that elegance, you know. And Mr. Jones said, I dress for what I am. The teacher shook his head, and Mr. Jones went back to his Times. On the ferry back that day, the other teacher told me Mr. Jones didn't see himself as a Negro at all, that he'd called to the black kids to stop bopping down the hall. The black kids didn't know what to make of Mr. Jones with all that elegance. They knew that whatever music they liked, Mr. Jones would be up there talking about Mozart, playing his music on the phonograph, or illustrating passages on the piano. And when it was time for the Christmas assembly, he'd have his boys and girls up on the stage, caroling like angels. Every morning on the ferry, I passed the Statue of Liberty in Ellis Island and thought of my mother and father coming to this country. When they sailed in, were they excited as I was that first sunny October morning? Teachers going to McKee and other schools in Staten Island sat on the ferry and looked towards the statue and the island. They must have thought of their parents and grandparents coming into this place, and they might have thought of all the hundreds who were sent back. It must have saddened them the way it saddened me to see Ellis Island neglected and crumbling. And that ferry, docked by the side, low in the water. The ferry that took the immigrants from Ellis Island to the island of Manhattan. And if they looked hard enough, they saw ghosts, hungry for the landing. Mam had moved with Alfie to an apartment on the west side. Then Alfie left to be his own man in the Bronx, and Mam moved to Flatbush Avenue near Grand Army Plaza in Brooklyn. Her building was shabby, but she felt comfortable having a place of her own, where she'd be under obligation to nobody. She could walk to any number of bingo games, and she was content, thank you. In my early years at McKee High School, I enrolled at Brooklyn College for classes leading to a master's degree in English. I started with summer courses and continued with afternoon and evening classes into the academic year. I would take the ferry from Staten Island to Manhattan and walk to a subway train at Bowling Green that took me to the end of the Flatbush line near Brooklyn College. On ferry and train, I could read for my classes or correct the work of my students at McKee. I told my students I wanted neat, clean, legible work, but they handed in whatever they'd scribble quickly on buses and trains and shop classes when the teacher wasn't looking or in the cafeteria. The papers were dotted with the stains of coffee, coke, ice cream, ketchup, sneezes, and a lusciousness where girls had blotted their lips. A set of such papers would so irritate me, I'd fling them over the side of the ferry and watch with satisfaction while they sank below the water to create a sargasso of illiteracy. When they asked for the papers, I told them they were so bad that if I had returned them, each paper would have been given a zero, and would they prefer that to nothing at all? They weren't sure, and when I thought of it, I wasn't sure myself. Zero or nothing at all? We discussed it for a whole period and decided that nothing at all was better than zero on your report card because you can't divide nothing at all by anything, and you can divide zero if you use algebra or something like that because a zero is something and nothing at all is nothing at all, and nobody could argue with that. Also, if your parents see a zero on your report card, they're upset, the ones who care. But if they see nothing at all, they don't know what to think, and it's better to have a father and mother who don't know what to think than a father and mother looking at a zero and giving you a punch upside your head. After my classes at Brooklyn College, I would sometimes leave the train at Bergen Street to visit my mother. If she knew I was coming, she'd make soda bread so warm and delicious it melted in the mouth as fast as the butter she slathered on it. She made tea in a teapot and couldn't help sniffing at the idea of tea bags. I told her tea bags were just a convenience for people with busy lives, and she said, "No one is so busy they can't take time to make a decent cup of tea. And if you're that busy, you don't deserve a decent cup of tea, for what is it all about anyway? Are we put into this world to be busy or to chat over a nice cup of tea?" My brother Michael married Donna from California in Malika's apartment on West 93rd Street. Mam brought a new dress for the occasion, but you could see she didn't approve of the proceedings. There was her lovely son Michael getting married and no sign of a priest, nothing but a Protestant minister in the living room who could pass for a grocer or an off-duty policeman in his collar and tie. Maliki had rented 24 folded chairs, and when we took our places, I noticed Mam's absence. She was in the kitchen, smoking a cigarette. I told her the wedding was about to begin, and she told me she had to finish her cigarette. "Mam, for Christ's sake, your son is getting married." She said that was his problem. She had to finish her fag. And when I told her she was keeping everyone waiting, her face tightened. The nose went up in the air. She stubbed out her butt in the ashtray and took her time going to the living room. On the way in, she whispered she had to go to the bathroom, and I hissed at her that she'd bloody well have to wait. She sat in her chair and stared over the head of the Protestant minister. No matter what was said, no matter what softness or sweetness surged here, she wouldn't be part of it, wouldn't yield. And when bride and groom were kissed and hugged, Mam sat with her purse in her lap, staring straight ahead, so that the world would know she was seeing nothing. especially the sight of her lovely son Michael falling into the clutches of Protestants and their ministers. When I visited Mam on Flatbush Avenue and we had the tea, she said, wasn't it a peculiar thing she was back in this part of the world after all these years? A place where she had 5 children, though 3 would die, the little girl here in Brooklyn, and the twin boys in Ireland. It might have been too much for her to think about that little girl, dead at 21 days, a short distance from here. She knew that if you walked down Flatbush Avenue to where it crossed Atlantic Avenue, you'd still see the bars my father went wild in, spending his wages, forgetting his children. No, she wouldn't talk about that either. When I asked her about her days in Brooklyn, she doled out scraps and then went silent. What was the use? The past is the past, and it's dangerous to go back. She must have had nightmares alone in that apartment. Chapter 45. Stanley spends more time in the teacher's cafeteria than anyone. When he sees me, he sits with me, drinks coffee, smokes cigarettes, and delivers monologues and everything. Like most teachers, he has 5 classes, but his speech therapy students are often absent because of the shame of stammering and trying to make themselves understood with cleft palates. Stanley gives them inspirational speeches, and even though he tells them they're as good as anyone else, they don't believe him. Some are in my regular English classes, and they write compositions, saying it's all right for Mr. Garber to talk, he's a nice guy and all, but he doesn't know what it's like to walk up to a girl and ask her to dance when you can't get the first word out of your mouth. Oh yeah, it's all right for Mr. Garber to help their stammer with singing in his class. But what good is that when you go to the dance? In the summer of 1961, Alberta wanted to be married at Grace Episcopal Church in Brooklyn Heights. I refused. I told her I'd rather be married in City Hall than in some pale imitation of the one holy Roman Catholic and Apostolic Church. Episcopalians irritated me. Why couldn't they stop the damn nonsense? They're up there with their statues and crosses and holy water and even confession. So why don't they call Rome and tell them they want to return? Alberta said, all right, all right. And we went to the municipal building in Manhattan. He wasn't required, but we had Brian McPhillips as best man and his wife Joyce as bridesmaid. Our ceremony was delayed because of a quarrel between the couple ahead of us. She said to him, you going to be married to me with that green umbrella on your arm? He said that was his umbrella, and he wasn't going to leave it out in this office to be stolen. She nodded towards us and told him, these people ain't going to steal your goddamn green umbrella, excuse the language, on my wedding day. He said he wasn't accusing nobody of nothing, but goddamn he paid a lot for that umbrella in Chamber Street from a guy that steals them, and he wasn't giving it up for nobody. She told him, well then, marry your damn umbrella. And she picked up her bag and walked out. He told her if she walked out now, that was the end. And she turned to the 4 of us and the woman behind the desk and the official coming out of the small wedding chapel and said, the end? What are you talking about, man? We've been living together these 3 years and you tell me this is the end? You don't tell me this is the end. I tell you, and I'm telling you, that umbrella ain't going to my wedding. And if you insist, there's a certain party in South Carolina, a certain ex-wife, that would like to know where you're at, and I'd be glad to tell her, if you know what I mean. Certain party looking for alimony and child support, so you take your choice, Byron, me in that little room with the man and no umbrella, or you back in South Carolina with your umbrella standing before a judge telling you, pay up, Byron, support your wife and child. The official at the door of the wedding chapel asked if they were ready. Byron asked me if I was the one getting married today, and would I mind holding his umbrella, because he could see that I was like him, going nowhere but into that little room, End of the road, man. End of the road. I wished him good luck, but he shook his head and said, Damn, why we all whoop like this? In a few minutes they were back to sign papers, the bride smiling, Byron grim. We all wished them good luck again and followed the official into the room. He smiled and said, Are we all assembled? Brian looked at me, raised his eyebrows. The official said, Do you promise to love, honor, cherish? And I struggled to keep myself from laughing. How could I survive this wedding conducted by a man with such a powerful lisp? I'd have to think of some way of controlling myself. That's it. The umbrella on my arm. Oh, God, I'll fall apart. I'm caught between the lisp and the umbrella, and I can't laugh. Alberta would kill me for laughing at my own wedding. You're allowed to weep with joy, but you must never laugh. And here I am made helpless by this man with the lisp, promising this and that. First man ever in New York to be married with a green umbrella on his arm. Solemn thought that kept me from laughing. And the ceremony was over, the ring on Alberta's finger, groom and bride kissing and being congratulated by Brian and Joyce, till the door opened and there was Byron. Man, you got my umbrella? You did that for me, kept it right here. Want to have a drink? Celebrate? Alberta signaled no to me with a little shake of her head. I told Byron I was sorry. We were meeting friends who were giving us a party. You lucky man. You have friends. Me and Selma going out to have a sandwich and go to a movie. I don't mind. Movie keeps her quiet. Ha ha ha. Thanks for watching my umbrella. Byron and Selma left, and I fell against the wall, laughing. Alberta tried to keep a bit of dignity in the occasion, but she gave way when she saw Brian and Joyce laughing too. I tried to tell them how the thought of the green umbrella saved me from laughing over the lisp, but the more I tried to talk, the more helpless I became, till we were clutching each other, going down in the elevator, and wiping our eyes outside in the August sun. It was a short walk to Diamond Dan O'Rourke's saloon, for drinks and sandwiches with friends Frank Schwacke and his wife Jean, and Jim Collins and his new wife Sheila Malone. After that there was to be a party out in Queens, given by Brian and Joyce, who would drive Alberta and me in their Volkswagen. Schwacke bought me a drink, so did Collins and Brian. The bartender bought us around, and I bought him a drink and left a big tip. He laughed and said I should get married every day. I bought drinks for Schwacke and Collins and Brian, and they all wanted to buy me one again. Joyce whispered to Brian, and I knew she was worried about the drinking. Alberta told me to slow down. She understood it was my wedding day, but it was early, and I should have respect for her and the guests at the reception later. I told her we were married barely 5 minutes, and she was already telling me what to do. Of course I had respect for her and the guests. That's all I ever had was respect, and I was weary of having respect. I told her back off, and there was such a state of tension, Collins and Brian intervened. Brian said it was his job. That's what best men are for. Collins said he knew me longer than Brian, but Brian said, No, you don't. I went to college with him. Collins said he didn't know that. McCourt, how come you never told me you went to college with McPhillips? I told him I never saw a need to tell the world who I went to college with, and for some reason that made us all laugh. The bartender said it was nice to see people happy on their wedding day, and we laughed even harder thinking of lisps and green umbrellas, and Alberta telling me have respect for her and the guests. Of course I had respect for her on our wedding day, till I went to the toilet and started thinking of how she rejected me for another man. And I was ready to go out and confront her, till I slipped on the slimy floor of the toilet in Diamond Dan O'Rourke's and banged my head so hard against the big urinal I had a headache that made me forget the rejection. Alberta wanted to know why the back of my jacket was damp, and when I told her there was a leak in the men's room, she didn't believe me. You fell, didn't you? No, I didn't fall. There was a leak. She wouldn't believe me, told me I was drinking too much, and that so irritated me, I was ready to walk out and live with a ballerina in a loft in Greenwich Village, till Brian said, Oh, come on, don't be an ass. It's Alberta's wedding day, too. Before going out to Queens, we had to pick up a wedding cake at Schraff's on West 57th Street. Joyce said she'd drive, because Brian and I had been too enthusiastic with the celebration at Diamond Dan's, while she and Alberta were saving themselves for the party that night. She stopped opposite Schraff's and said no when Brian offered to get the cake, but he insisted and dodged the traffic. Joyce shook her head and said he was going to get killed. Alberta told me go help him, but Joyce shook her head again and said that would only make things worse. Brian came out of Schraff's holding a big cake box against his chest and once more dodged cars till a taxi sideswiped him slightly at the street's dividing line and the box fell to the ground. Joyce put her forehead against the steering wheel. Oh, God, she said, and I said I was going to help my best man, Brian. No, no, Alberta said, I'll go. I told her this was man's work, that I wouldn't risk her life with these mad taxis on 57th Street, and I went to help Brian, who was on his hands protecting the wrecked cake from the traffic zooming by him right and left. I knelt with him, tore a cardboard flap from the box, and we shoveled the cake back in, with bits hanging here and there. The little bride and groom figures looked sad, but we wiped them off and stuck them back on the cake, not the top, because we didn't know where the top was anymore, but somewhere in the cake where we could push them in for the security. Joyce and Alberta called to us from the car that we'd better get off the street before the police came or we were killed, and they were tired of waiting anyway. Hurry up! When we got into the car, Joyce told Brian, pass the cake back to Alberta for safekeeping. But he turned stubborn and said no. After all his troubles, he'd hold on to it till we were at the apartment. And he did, even if he had bits of cream and little green and yellow decorations all over his lap and his suit in general. The wives treated us coolly the rest of the way in the car, talking only to each other and making comments on the Irish, and how you can't trust them with a simple task like crossing a street with a wedding cake. How these Irish couldn't have one or two drinks and be content till the reception. Oh, no. They had to talk and treat each other to rounds till they're in such a condition you couldn't send them to the grocery for a quart of milk. Look at him, Joyce said. And when I saw Brian dozing away with his chin on his chest, I nodded off, while the wives went on with their lamentation about the Irish in general and this day in particular, Alberta saying, everyone warned me that the Irish are great to go out with, but never marry them. I would have defended my race and told her how her Yankee ancestors had nothing to be proud of, the way they treated the Irish with those signs everywhere that said, no Irish need apply, except that I was weary from the strain of being married by a man with a lisp, while I carried Byron's green umbrella and my heavy responsibility as groom and host at Diamond Dan O'Rourke's. If I hadn't slumped with the weariness, I would have reminded her how her ancestors hanged women right and left for being witches, how they were a dirty-minded lot, rolling their eyes in shock and horror at the mention of sex, but having a grand time between their thighs, listening in court to hysterical Puritan maidens claiming the devil appeared in various forms and frolicked with them in the woods and how they became so devoted to him, all decency went out the window. I would have told Alberta how the Irish never carried on like that. In the whole history of Ireland, only one witch was hanged, and she was probably English and deserved it. And just to clinch it, I would have told her the first witch to be hanged in New England was Irish, and they did it to her because she said her prayers in Latin and wouldn't stop. Instead of saying all this, I fell asleep till Alberta shook me and told me we were there. Joyce insisted on taking the cake from Brian. She didn't want him to fall forward on the stairs and crush the cake entirely, and she still had hopes of reconstructing it so that we'd have some semblance of a cake and people could sing "The Bride Cuts the Cake." People arrived, and there was eating, drinking, dancing, and misunderstandings between all the couples, married and unmarried. Frank Schwaki wouldn't talk to his wife, Jean. Jim Collins quarreled in a corner with his wife, Sheila. There was still a coolness between Alberta and me, and between Brian and Joyce. Other couples were affected, and there were islands of tension all over the apartment. The night would have been ruined except for the way we were all united against an outside danger. One of Alberta's friends, a German named Dietrich, drove off in his Volkswagen to replenish the beer supply. And when he returned, there was trouble with the owner of a Buick he had backed into. Someone told me about the trouble outside, and since I was the bridegroom, it was my duty to make peace. The Buick man was a giant, and poking his fist into the face of Alberta's friend. When I stepped between them, he let loose with his big punch. His arm swung around the back of my head, into Dietrich's eye, and we all fell to the ground. We wrestled a bit, one with another, no one a bit particular, till Schwacke, Collins, and McPhillips separated us, with the Buick man threatening to tear Dietrich's head from his shoulders. When we dragged the German inside, I discovered my trouser knee was ripped, the kneecap bleeding. The knuckles of my right hand bled too, from being scraped along the ground. Upstairs, Alberta started to cry, telling me I was ruining the whole night. My blood boiled a bit, and I told her I was only trying to be a peacemaker, and it wasn't my fault if I was knocked down by that baboon next door. Besides, I was helping her German friend, and she should be grateful. The argument would have continued if Joyce hadn't stepped in to call everyone to the table for the cutting of the cake. When she slipped off the covering cloth, Brian laughed and kissed her for being such a genius of an artist. You'd never know this cake was scooped off the street a short time ago. The little bride and groom were secure, though his head wobbled and fell, and I told Joyce, "Uneasy lies the groom that wears a head." Everyone sang. The bride cuts the cake, the groom cuts the cake, and Alberta looked mollified, even though we couldn't cut proper slices, and the cake had to be dished out in chunks. Joyce said she was making coffee, and Alberta said that would be nice, but Brian said we should have one more drink to toast the newlyweds, and I agreed. And Alberta got so angry, she ripped the wedding ring from her finger and threw it out the window, though she remembered suddenly that was her grandmother's wedding ring from early in the century, and now it was out the window, God knows where in Queens, and what was she going to do? It was all my fault and her great mistake for marrying me. Brian said we'd have to find that ring. We didn't have a flashlight, but we were able to light up the night with matches and cigarette lighters as we crawled across the lawn below Brian's window, till Dietrich shouted he had the ring, and everyone forgave him for stirring up trouble with a big Buick man. Alberta refused to replace the ring on her finger. She'd keep it in her purse till she was sure of this marriage. She and I took a taxi with Jim Collins and Sheila. They would drop us at our apartment in Brooklyn and continue into Manhattan. Sheila wasn't talking to Jim, and Alberta wasn't talking to me. But as we swung into State Street, I grabbed her and told her, "I'm going to consummate this marriage tonight." She said, "Oh, consummate my ass." And I said, "That'll do." The taxi stopped, and I climbed from the back seat I had shared with Sheila and Alberta. Jim got out of the seat by the driver and came to where I stood on the sidewalk. He intended to say good night and get back in with Sheila, but Alberta pulled the door shut, and the taxi drove away. "Christ almighty," said Collins. "This is your goddamn wedding night, McCourt. Where's your bride? Where's mine?" We climbed the stairs to my apartment, found a six-pack of Schlitz in the refrigerator, sat on the couch, the two of us, and watched television Indians drop from the bullets of John Wayne. Chapter 46. In the summer of 1963... Mam called to say she had a letter from my father. He claimed he was a new man, that he hadn't had a drink in 3 years and worked now as a chef in a monastery. I told her if my father was a monastery chef, The monks must have been on a permanent fast. She didn't laugh, and that said she was troubled. She read from the letter where he said he was coming with a 3-week return ticket on the Queen Mary, and how he looked forward to the day when we could all be together again, he and she sharing a bed and a grave, for he knew, and she knew, that whatever God had joined, let no man put asunder. She sounded uncertain. What should she do? Maliki had already told her why not. She wanted to know what I thought. I put it back to her. What do you think? After all, this was the man who put her through hell in New York and Limerick. And now he wants to sail to her side, a safe harbor in Brooklyn. I don't know what to do, she said. She didn't know what to do because she was lonely in that dingy place on Flatbush Avenue, and now she was illustrating that Irish saying, contention is better than loneliness. She could take back this man or, at 55, face the years alone. I told her I'd meet her for coffee at Junior's restaurant. She was there before me, puffing and gasping on a strong American cigarette. No, she wouldn't have tea. The Americans can send a man into space, but they can't make a decent cup of tea, so she'd have coffee and some of that nice cheesecake. She drew on the cigarette, sipped the coffee, and told me she didn't know under God what to do. She said the whole family was falling apart, with Maliki separated from his wife Linda and the 2 small children, Mike off to California with his wife Donna and their child, Alfie disappeared into the Bronx. She said she could have a nice life for herself in Brooklyn with the bingo and the odd meeting of the Limerick Ladies Association in Manhattan. And why should she let the man from Belfast upset that life? I drank my coffee and ate my strudel, knowing that she'd never admit she was lonely, though she might have been thinking, sure, if it wasn't for the drink, he wouldn't be that bad to live with at all. I told her what I was thinking. Well, she said, he'd be company for me, if he's not drinking, if he's a new man. We could take walks in Prospect Park, and he could meet me after the bingo. All right. Tell him to come for the 3 weeks, and we'll see if he's a new man. On the way back to her apartment, she stopped often to press her hand against her chest. 'Tis my heart, she said, going a mile a minute, so 'tis. It must be the cigarettes. Oh, I don't know. Then it must be the nervousness over that letter. Oh, I don't know. I just don't know. At her door, I kissed her cold cheek and watched her gasping her way upstairs. My father had put years in her. When Mam and Maliki went to meet the new man at the pier, he arrived so drunk he had to be helped off the ship. The purser told him he'd gone wild with the drink and had to be kept in restraint. I was away that day, and when I returned I took the subway to see him at Mam's apartment, but he'd gone with Maliki to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We drank tea and waited. She said again she didn't know under God what to do. He was the same lunatic with the drink, and all that talk about being a new man was a lie, and she was glad he had a 3-week return ticket. Still there was a darkness in her eyes that told me she must have had hopes of a normal family, her man by her side, with sons and grandchildren coming to her from all over New York. They returned from the meeting. Maliki, big, red-bearded and sober because of his troubles. My father, older and smaller. Maliki had tea. My father said, "Och, no," and lay on the couch with his hands joined under his head. Maliki left his tea to stand over him and lecture him. "You have to admit you're an alcoholic. That's the first step." Dad shook his head. "Why are you shaking your head? You are an alcoholic, and you have to admit it." "Ach, no. I'm not an alcoholic like these poor people at the meeting. I don't drink kerosene." Maliki threw up his hands and returned to his tea at the table. We didn't know what to say to each other in the presence of this man on the couch, husband, father. I had my memories of him, mornings by the fire in Limerick, his stories and songs, his cleanliness, neatness and sense of order, the way he helped us with our schoolwork, his insistence on obedience and attention to our religious duties, all destroyed by his payday madness, when he threw his money around the pubs, buying pints for every hanger-on, while my mother despaired by the fire, knowing the next day she'd have to stick her hand out for charity. I knew that if blood called to blood, I'd drift to my father's side of the family. My mother's people had often said in Limerick I had the odd manner of my father and a strong streak of the north in my character. They may have been right, because whenever I went to Belfast, they felt at home. He sat up on the couch and asked if we'd like to go for a walk. Mam and Maliki said no, they were tired. They'd spent more time with him than I, and must have been weary of his shenanigans. I said yes, because this was my father, and I was a 9-year-old, 33-year-old. He put on his cap, and we walked down Flatbush Avenue. "Ach," he said, "it's a very warm kind of a night." "'Tis." "A very warm," he said. "You'd be in danger of drying up in a night like this." Ahead of us was the Long Island Railroad Station, ringed with bars for the thirsty commuters. I asked if he remembered the bars. "Ach," he said, "why should I remember such places? Because you drank in them, and we searched for you." "Ach, well, I might have worked in one or two, when times were hard, for the bread and meat they gave me to take home to you, Childer." He remarked again in the heat of the night, "and surely it wouldn't do us any harm to cool ourselves in one of these places." "I thought you didn't drink." "Ah, that's right, I gave it up." "Well, what about the ship? You had to be carried off." "Ah, that was the seasickness. I will have something here for the coolness." While we drank our beer, he told me my mother was a fine woman, and I should be good to her. That Maliki was a fine big lad, though you'd hardly know him with that red beard, and where did it come from? That he was sorry to hear I had married a Protestant, though it wasn't too late for her to convert, nice girl that she was. And he was happy to hear I was a teacher like all his sisters in the north. And would there be any harm in having another beer? No, there wouldn't be any harm. And there wasn't any harm in the beers we had up and down Flatbush Avenue. And when we arrived back at my mother's apartment, I left him at the door, because I didn't want to see the looks on the faces of Mam and Maliki that would accuse me of leading my father astray, or vice versa. He wanted to continue drinking up towards Grand Army Plaza, but my guilt told me to say no. He was supposed to leave next day in the Queen Mary, though he hoped my mother would say, "Ah, stay. Sure we'll find some way of getting along." I said that would be lovely, and he said we'd all be together again and things would be better because he was a new man. We shook hands, and I left. Next morning, Mam called and said, "He went pure mad, so he did." "What did he do?" "You brought him home drunk as a lord." "He wasn't drunk. He had a few beers." "He had more than that. And I was here by myself with Maliki gone into Manhattan. A bottle of whiskey he had, your father, that he brought from the ship. And I had to call the cops, and he's gone now, bag and baggage, and sailed away today in the Queen Mary, because I called Cunard, and they told me, oh yes, they had him on board, and they'd be watching closely for any signs of the lunacy he came with." "What did he do?" She wouldn't tell me, and she didn't have to, because it was easy to guess. He probably tried to get into bed with her, and that was not part of her dream. She hinted and suggested that if I hadn't spent hours with him in saloons, he would have behaved himself and wouldn't be on the Queen Mary now, heading out into the Atlantic. I told her his drinking wasn't my fault, but she was sharp with me. "Last night was the last straw," she said, "and you were part of it." Chapter 47. For teachers, Fridays are bright. You leave the school with a bag filled with papers to read and correct, books to read. This weekend, you will surely catch up with all those uncorrected, unmarked papers. You don't want to let them pile up in the closets like Miss Mudd, so that decades hence a young teacher will pounce on them to keep his classes busy. You'll take the papers home, pour a glass of wine, stack Duke Ellington, Sonny Rollins, and Hector Berlioz on the phonograph, and try to read 150 student compositions. You know that some don't care what you do with their work as long as you give them a decent grade so they can pass and get on with real life in their shops. Others fancy themselves as writers and want their papers back corrected and graded high. The class Romeos would like you to comment on their papers and read them aloud, so that they can bask in the admiring glances of the girls. The ones who don't care are sometimes interested in the same girls, and verbal threats are passed from desk to desk, because the ones who don't care are weak in written expression. If a boy is a good writer, you have to be careful about praising him too much because of the danger of accidents on the stairs. The ones who don't care hate goody-goodies. You intend to go straight home with your bag, but you then discover Friday afternoon is the time for beer and teacher enlightenment. An occasional teacher might say he has to go home to his wife, till he finds Bob Bogart standing by the time clock to remind us of first things first, that the Murat bar is a few steps away, next door in fact, and what harm would there be in one beer? One? Bob is not married, and may not understand the dangers for a man who might go beyond the one beer, a man who might have to face the wrath of a wife who has cooked a fine fried fish and now sits in the kitchen watching the grease congeal. We stand at the Murat bar and order our beers. There's teacher small talk. When there's mention of good-looking women on our staff, or even nubile students, we roll our eyes. What we wouldn't do if we were high school kids nowadays. We talk tough at the mention of troublesome boys. One more word out of that goddamn kid and he's gonna beg for a transfer. We unite in our hostility to authority. All the people who emerge from their offices to supervise and observe us and tell us what to do and how to do it. People who spend as little time as possible in the classroom themselves and don't know their ass from their elbow about teaching. A young teacher might drop in, just graduated from college, newly licensed. The drone of university professors and the chatter from college cafeterias is still in his ears. And if he wants to discuss Camus and Sartre and how existence precedes essence or vice versa, he'll be talking to himself in the mirror of the Murat bar. None of us had followed the great American path. Elementary school, high school, college, and into teaching at 22. Bob Bogart fought in the war in Germany and was probably wounded, he won't tell you. Claude Campbell served in the Navy. Graduated from college in Tennessee, published a novel when he was 27, teaches English, has 6 children with his second wife, took a master's degree at Brooklyn College with a thesis, Ideational Trends in the American Novel, fixes everything in his house, wiring, plumbing, carpentry. I look at him and think of Goldsmith's lines on the village schoolmaster, and all around the wonder grew that one small head could carry all he knew. And Claude hasn't even reached the age of Christ at his crucifixion, 33. When Stanley Garber drops in for a Coke, he tells us he often feels he made a mistake by not going into college teaching, where you amble through life thinking you shit cream puffs and suffering if you have to teach more than 3 hours a week. He says he could have written a bullshit PhD dissertation on the bilabial fricative in the middle period of Thomas Chatterton, who died when he was 17, because that's the kind of crap that goes on in colleges, while the rest of us hold the front lines with kids who won't get their heads out from between their thighs, and supervisors content to keep their heads up their asses. There would be trouble tonight in Brooklyn. I'm supposed to have dinner with Alberta at an Arabic restaurant, the Near East. Bring your own wine. But it's 6 going on 7, and if I call now, she'll complain she's been waiting for hours, that I'm just an Irish drunk like my father. And she doesn't care if I stay on Staten Island the rest of my life, goodbye. So, I won't call. Better not to. No use having 2 rows, one on the phone now, another when I get home. It's easier to sit at the bar where there's a glow and important matters are discussed. We agreed that teachers are sniped at from 3 fronts. Parents, kids, supervisors. And you either have to be diplomatic or tell them all, kiss your ass. Teachers are the only professionals who have to respond to bells every 45 minutes and come out fighting. All right, class, sit down. Yes, you, sit down. Open your notebooks, that's right, your notebooks. Am I speaking a foreign language, kid? Don't call your kid. Okay, I won't call you kid. Just sit down. Report card grades are just around the corner, and I can put you on the welfare rolls. All right, bring in your father, bring in your mother, bring in your whole damn tribe. You don't have a pen, Pete? Okay, here's the pen. Goodbye, pen. No, Phyllis. You can't have the pass. I don't care if you're having 100 periods, Phyllis, because what you really want to do is meet Eddie and disappear into the basement, where your future could be determined by one smooth panty drop and one swift upward stroke from Eddie's impatient member, the start of a little 9-month adventure that will end with you squawking Eddie better marry you, the shotgun aimed at his lower frontal region and his dreams dead. So, I'm saving you, Phyllis, you and Eddie, and no, you don't have to thank me. This is talk along the bar that will never be heard in the classroom, unless a teacher loses his wits entirely. You know you can never deny the lavatory pass to a menstrual Phyllis for fear of being dragged before the highest court in the land, where the black robes, all men, will excoriate you for insulting Phyllis and the future mothers of America. There is talk along the bar about certain efficient teachers, and we agree we don't like them, and the way their classes are so organized they hum from bell to bell. In these classes there are monitors for every activity, every part of the lesson. There is the monitor who goes immediately to the board to write the number and title of the day's lesson. Lesson number 32, Strategies in Dealing with the Dangling Participle. Efficient teachers are known for their strategies, the darling new word at the Board of Education. The efficient teacher has rules for taking notes and the organization of the notebook, and there are notebook monitors who roam the classroom to check for proper form. Top of page filled with student's name, homeroom class, title of course, and date with a month written out, not numbers. It must be written out so that the student will have practice in writing out, because there are too many people in this world that we live in, business people and others, who are too lazy to write out the months. There are to be prescribed margins and no scribbling. If the notebook doesn't adhere to the rules, the monitor will enter demerits on the student's card, and when report card time rolls around, there will be suffering and no mercy. Homework monitors collect and return assignments. Attendance monitors preside over the little cards in the attendance book and collect excuses for absences and latenesses. Failure to submit written excuses leads to further suffering and no mercy. Some students are known for their skill in writing excuse notes from parents and doctors, and they'll do it in return for favors in the cafeteria or the far reaches of the basement. Monitors who take blackboard erasers to the basement to knock out the chalk must first promise they're not taking this important job to sneak a smoke or make out with the boy or girl of their choice. The principal is already complaining there's too much activity in the basement, and he'd like to know what's going on there. There are monitors to distribute books and collect receipts, monitors to handle the lavatory pass and the sign-in, sign-out sheet, monitors to put everything in the room in alphabetical order, Monitors to carry the trash can along the aisles in the war against litter. Monitors who decorate the room to make it so bright and cheerful, the principal brings in visitors from Japan and Liechtenstein. The efficient teacher is monitor of monitors, though he may lighten his monitor load by appointing monitors who monitor the other monitors, or he may have dispute monitors who settle arguments between monitors accusing other monitors of interfering with their jobs. The dispute monitor has the most dangerous job of all because of what might happen on the stairs or the street. A student caught trying to bribe a monitor is immediately reported to the principal, who will enter a remark on his permanent record that will blacken his reputation. This is a warning to others that such a blot could be an impediment to a career in sheet metal, plumbing, auto mechanics, anything. Stanley Garber snorts that with all this efficient activity, there's little time for instruction, but what the hell? The students are in their seats, completely monitored and behaving themselves, and that pleases the teacher, the chairman, the principal and his assistants, the superintendent, the board of education, the mayor, the governor, the president, and God himself. So says Stanley. If a university professor discusses Vanity Fair or anything else, his classes listen with notebooks open and pens poised. If they dislike the novel, they won't dare complain for fear of lower grades. When I distributed Vanity Fair to my junior class at McKee Vocational and Technical High School, there was moaning in the room. Why do we have to read this dumb book? I told them it was about two young women, Becky and Amelia, and their adventures with men. But my students said it was written in their old English, and who can read that? Four girls read it and said it was beautiful and should be made into a movie. The boys pretended to yawn and told me English teachers were all the same. They just wanted to make you read that old stuff. And how was that going to help you if you was fixing a car or a busted air conditioner, eh? I could threaten them with failure. If they refused to read this book, they'd fail the course and they wouldn't graduate. And everyone knew girls didn't want to go out with anyone who wasn't a high school graduate. For 3 weeks, we toiled through Vanity Fair. Every day, I tried to motivate and encourage them, to draw them into a discussion of what it's like to make your way through the world when you're a young 19th century woman, but they didn't care. One wrote on the board, "Becky Sharp dropped dead." Then, as decreed by the school syllabus, it was onto the scarlet letter. This would be easier. I talk about the New England witch hunts, the accusations, the hysteria, the hangings. I talk about Germany in the 1930s and how a whole nation was brainwashed. Not my students. They'd never be brainwashed. No, sir. They'd never be able to get away with that here. They'd never fool us like that. I chanted to them, "Winston tastes good," and they finished the sentence. I sang, "My beer is Ryan Gold, the dry beer," and they finished the jingle. I chanted again, "You wonder where the yellow went," and they finished the line. I asked if they knew any more, and there was an eruption of jingles from radio and television, proof of the power of advertising. When I told them they were brainwashed, they were indignant. Oh no, they weren't brainwashed. They could think for themselves, and nobody could tell them what to do. They denied they'd been told what cigarette to smoke, what beer to drink, what toothpaste to use, though they'd admit that when you're in a supermarket, you'd buy the brand in your head. No, you'd never buy a cigarette called Turnip. Yeah, they heard about Senator McCarthy and all that, but they were too young, and their fathers and mothers said he was a great man for getting rid of the communists. From day to day, I struggled to make connections between Hitler and McCarthy and the New England witch hunts, trying to soften them up for the scarlet letter. From parents, there were indignant calls. "What is this guy telling our kids about Senator McCarthy? Tell him back off. Senator McCarthy was a good man, fought for his country. Tail Gunner Joe got rid of the communists." Mr. Sirola said he didn't want to interfere, But would I please tell him, was I teaching English or was I teaching history? I told him about my troubles trying to get the kids to read anything. He said I shouldn't listen to them. Just tell them you're going to read the Scarlet Letter whether you like it or not, because this is high school and that's what we do here and that's that. And if you don't like it, kid, you fail. They complained when I distributed the book. Here we go again with the old stuff. We thought you was a nice guy, Mr. McCourt. We thought you was different. I told them this book was about a young woman in Boston who got into trouble over having a baby with a man who wasn't her husband, though I couldn't tell them who the man was in case it might ruin the story. They said they didn't care who the father was. One boy said, you'll never know who your father is anyway, because he had a friend who discovered his father wasn't his father at all, that his real father was killed in Korea, but the pretend father was the one he grew up with, a good guy. So who gives a shit about this woman in Boston? Most of the class agreed that they wouldn't want to wake up in the morning to find their fathers weren't their real fathers. Some wished they had other fathers. Their own fathers were so mean, they made them come to school and read dumb books. But that's not the story of the Scarlet Letter, I said. Oh, Mr. McCourt, do we have to talk about that old stuff? This guy Hawthorne don't even know how to write so as we can understand, and you're always saying, write simple, write simple. Why can't we read the Daily News? They have good writers, they write simple. Then I remembered I was broke, and that's what led to Catcher in the Rye and five great plays of Shakespeare and a change in my teaching career. I had 48 cents to get me home on the ferry and the subway, no money for lunch, not even for a cup of coffee on the ferry, and I blurted to the class that if they wanted to read a good book that didn't have big words and long sentences and was all about a boy their age who was mad at the world, I'd get it for them, but they'd have to buy it, $1.25 each, which they could pay in installments starting now. So, if you have a nickel or a dime or more, you can pass it up, and I'll write your name and amount on a sheet of paper and order the books today from the Coleman Book Company in Yonkers. And they'd never know, my students. I'd have a pocket full of change for lunch and maybe a beer at the Murat next door, though I didn't tell them that. They'd be shocked. Small change was passed up. And when I called the book company, I saved a dime by using the assistant principal's phone, because it's illegal to have students buy books when book rooms are spilling over with copies of Silas Marner and Giants in the Earth. Catcher in the Rye arrived in 2 days, and I passed them out, paid for or not. Some students never offered a penny, others less than their share. But the money collected kept me going till payday, when I satisfied the book company. When I handed out the book, someone discovered the word crap on the first page, and that brought a silence to the room. That's a word you never find in any book in the English book room. Girls covered their mouths and giggled, and boys tittered over shocking pages. When the bell rang, there was no stampede to the door. I had to ask them to leave. Another class was coming in. The class coming in was curious about the class going out. And why was everyone looking at this book? And if it was that good, why couldn't they read it? I reminded them they were seniors, and the class going out were juniors. Yeah, but why couldn't they read that small book instead of Great Expectations? I told them they could, but they'd have to buy it. And they said they'd pay anything not to read Great Expectations. Anything. Next day, Mr. Sirola came into the room with his assistant, Miss Heasted. They went from desk to desk, snatching copies of Catcher in the Rye and dropping them into two shopping bags. If the books weren't on the desks, they demanded the students take them from their bags. They counted the books in the shopping bags and compared them with the class attendance, and threatened the four students who hadn't turned in their books with big trouble. Raise your hands, the four people who still have the book. No hands were raised. And on the way out, Mr. Sirola told me I was to see him in his office right after this class, not a minute later. Mr. McCourt, you in trouble? Mr. McCourt, that's the only book I ever read, and now that man took it. They complained about the loss of their books, and told me if anything happened to me, they'd go on strike, and that would teach the school a lesson. They nudged and winked over the strike. And they knew. I knew it would be simply another excuse for avoiding school, and not any great concern for me. Mr. Cirola sat behind his desk, reading Catcher in the Rye, puffing on his cigarette, and letting me wait while he turned the page, shook his head, and put the book down. Mr. McCourt, this book is not on the syllabus. I know, Mr. Cirola. You know I've had calls from 17 parents, and you know why? They didn't like the book? That's right, Mr. McCourt. There's a scene in this book where the kid is in a hotel room with a prostitute.
Yes, but nothing happens.
That's not what the parents think. You telling me that kid was in that room to sing? The parents don't want their kids reading this kind of trash. He warned me to be careful, that I was endangering my satisfactory rating on the yearly performance report, and we wouldn't want that, would we? He would have to place a note in my file as a record of our meeting. If there were no further incidents in the near future, the note would be removed. Mr. McCourt, what are we going to read next? The Scarlet Letter. We have tons of them in the book room. Their faces fell.
Oh, God, no. All the kids in the other classes told us it's that old stuff again.
All right, I said jokingly. We'll read Shakespeare. Their faces fell even farther, and the room was filled with moans and hisses.
Mr. McCourt, my sister went to college for a year and dropped out because she couldn't read Shakespeare, and she can speak Italian and everything.
I said it again. Shakespeare. There was fear in the room, and I felt myself drawn to the edge of a cliff with something in my head demanding, how can you move from Salinger to Shakespeare? I told the class, it's Shakespeare, or The Scarlet Letter, Kings and Lovers, or a woman having a baby in Boston. If we read Shakespeare, we'll act out the plays. If we read The Scarlet Letter, we'll sit here and discuss the deeper meaning, and I'll give you the big exam they keep in the department office.
Oh, no, not the deeper meaning. English teachers always be going on about the deeper meaning.
All right. It's Shakespeare. No deeper meaning, and no exams except what you decide. So, write your name on this paper and the amount you're paying, and we'll get the book. They passed up their nickels and dimes. They groaned when they thumbed the book, 5 great plays of Shakespeare.
Man, I can't read this old English.
Whatever happened in their class did not spring from any talent, intellect, or careful planning of mine. I wished I could have dominated my classes like other teachers, imposed on them classic English and American literature. I failed. I caved in and took the easy way with Catcher in the Rye and dodged and danced my way to Shakespeare. We'd read the plays and enjoy ourselves, and why not? Wasn't he the best? Still, my students complained till someone called out,
shit, man! Excuse the language, Mr. McCorper. Here's this guy saying, friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears.
Where? Where? The class wanted to know the page number, and all around the room boys declaimed Mark Antony's speech, flung out their arms and laughed. Another discovered Hamlet's to be or not to be soliloquy, and soon the room was filled with ranting Hamlets. The girls raised their hands.
Mr. McCourt, the boys have all these great speeches, and there's nothing for us.
Oh, girls, girls, there's Juliet, Lady Macbeth, Ophelia, Gertrude. We spent 2 days plucking morsels from the 5 plays. Romeo and Juliet, Julius Caesar, Macbeth, Hamlet, Henry IV, Part 1. My students led, and I followed, because there was nothing else to do. Remarks had been passed in the hallways in the students' cafeteria.
Hey, what's that?
It's a book, man.
Oh, yeah, what book?
Shakespeare. We're reading Shakespeare.
Shakespeare? Shit, man, you're not reading Shakespeare.
When the girls wanted to act out Romeo and Juliet, the boys yawned and obliged. This will be sissy romantic stuff till the fight scene where Mercutio dies in style, telling the world about his wound. 'Tis not as deep as a well, nor as wide as the church door, but 'tis enough. 'Twill serve. To be or not to be was the passage everyone memorized, but when they recited it, they had to be reminded this was a meditation on suicide and not an incitement to arms.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. The girls wanted to know why everyone picked on Ophelia, especially Laertes, Polonius, Hamlet. Why didn't she fight back? They had sisters like that who were married to bastard sons of bitches, excuse the language, and you wouldn't believe what they had to put up with. A hand went up.
Why didn't Ophelia run away to America?
Another hand.
Because there was no America in the old days, it had to be discovered.
What are you talking about? There was always an America. Where do you think the Indians lived? I told them they'd have to look it up, and the opposing hands agreed to go to the library and report next day. One hand. There was an America in Shakespeare's time, and she could have went. The other hand. There was an America in Shakespeare's time, but no America in Ophelia's time, and she couldn't have went. If she went in Shakespeare's time, there was nothing but Indians, and Ophelia would have been uncomfortable in a teepee, which is what they call their houses. We moved on to Henry IV, Part 1, and all the boys wanted to be Hal, Hotspur, Falstaff. The girls complained again. There was nothing for them except Juliet, Ophelia, Lady Macbeth, and Queen Gertrude, and look what happened to them. Didn't Shakespeare like women? Did he have to kill everyone who wore a skirt? The boys said, that's the way it is. And the girls snapped back, they were sorry we didn't read the Scarlet Letter, because one of them had read it and told the rest how Hester Prynne had her beautiful baby Pearl, and the father was a jerk who died miserable, and Hester got her revenge on the whole town of Boston, and wasn't that much better than poor Ophelia floating down a stream, out of her mind, talking to herself and throwing flowers around, wasn't it? Mrs. Sorolla came to observe me with the new head of the academic department, Mrs. Pop. They smiled and didn't complain about this Shakespeare book not being on the syllabus, though the next term, Mrs. Pop took this class away from me. I lodged the grievance and had a hearing before the superintendent. I said that was my class, I had started them reading Shakespeare, and I wanted to continue in the next term. The superintendent ruled against me on the grounds that my attendance record was spotty and erratic. My Shakespeare students were probably lucky in having the head of the department as their teacher. She was surely more organized than I, and more likely to discover deeper meanings.